I want to start with some like service announcements about what is on the portal. I sent this email out. By the way, I see a couple of new faces, so if you want to be added to the mailing list for the course, let me know if you're not receiving emails yet. So on the portal, I've posted the plan of the course in a more detailed fashion with the usual information. But also the first chapter of the lecture notes, which is more of a motivational chapter, which I will not discuss in the lectures, but I'm happy to discuss in person. So if you want to, if you're curious and want to have a look, please do. I also posted the first homework. There will be only one homework for the class. It's, however, a bit long, that's why there is one. And also a bit unconventional. So you will be asked to go through some papers, not in great detail necessarily. Just one of them requires some detailed reading. The others is more about the conceptual understanding of what is happening. So this homework, I haven't posted a deadline yet. I think it will be roughly the end of the course. Because I want you to be free in May as well, so I don't want you to push it too far beyond that. So it's already available. It's not related strictly to the content of the lectures. It's more of a parallel track, so you can start working on it whenever you like. So this is about the homework. And okay, what is this course about and what is it not about? So it's not about any specific approach to quantum gravity. Maybe it is in spirit, in the sense that it's about understanding GR as, in some sense, as a gauge theory and trying to understand its symmetries in a deep way. And what I hope you will get out of the course is to understand why it's hard to quantize it compared to other theories. So in this sense, it is a pre-quantum gravity course. I want to do all the groundwork that is often not done. A bit over, there is a bit of a blind spot in many. I don't know. There was in my own formation. This is stuff that I learned after learning about one particular approach of quantum gravity. But I thought it would have been nice to hear it before delving into some specific approaches. It's not fully. Well, it's tangentially compatible to maybe string theory, where gravity is more of emergent theory, effective theory at low energy, and so on. So, but the tools we will use, and this is something that and develop, talk to any theory, whether it's a field theory, string theory, and so on. So in a way, one of the things I was aiming to was to teach you not just about GR and its symmetries, but also some technical tools that can be applied more broadly. So I hope this clarifies a little bit what I'm aiming for. Again, there is more information in the first chapter of the notes, which is already on the portal. So a more detailed plan is the following. Most of the focus of this course will be on a geometric formulation of mechanics and field theory, and in particular, theories with gauge symmetries and GR. So to do this as a warm-up, we will revise standard mechanics. I will go rather fast. We've done this in classical theory. And at the beginning of the year, of course, you might have forgotten or need some refresh of certain concepts. So I will go through them. It will be fast. You can stop me anytime if you need me to slow down. So that's absolutely fine. I have to do these also because everything will build up on those ideas and kind of bring them to slightly different directions. And these slightly different directions go under the name of covariant phase-space formalism, which is this formalism that allows us to study, in particular, general relativity and its symmetries in this more in-depth way, understanding. Different layers of the problem of GR's dynamics and its relation to its symmetries. It's also this kind of universal tool I was talking about that one can use in many different applications. And we will go through Wolff's derivation of black hole entropy as a neuter charge in particular, as an example of these tools which are related to GR and certain ideas about what quantum gravity is, but it is, again, not technically, there will be no H-bar. Then after that, we will take the, we will try to understand how this covariant phase space formalism relates to the canonical phase space, which is usually the starting point for canonical quantization. So theories like loop quantum gravity start from a canonical formulation of general relativity in a specific set of variables and so on, and try to quantize them. And in particular, what you want to do is to find a representation of the symmetry algebra and so on and so forth, and we will see why this is challenging during the later part of the course. So here we get, in particular, GR constraint algebra, and the importance of general covariance and its power. So in particular, how to reconstruct GR from its symmetries. And this has important implication for why it's hard to quantize gravity. During the course, we will have some glimpses into quantum gravity, among others, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. I will try to explain what it is about. It's a formal equation, more of a. It's not rigorously defined in a way, but it contains. I will try to explain why it contains all the information about quantum general relativity, at least on a conceptual level. And also in a tutorial, we will look into Hasse-Kars variable and try to understand why they make, they were a breakthrough and they made the analysis of, like, clarified the or simplified the understanding of the constraint algebra of general relativity. Okay. Any questions about the roadmap? So the course proceeds on, in a way, tutorials and lectures are on roughly the same track. Tutorials lag a bit behind. I will say many things in the lectures that will not have a counterpart in the tutorial necessarily. Then the homework is kind of this parallel track, and I didn't say what the theme is. The theme is whether it's it's possible to detect a single graviton, why this question is interesting, and what it means for, and which historical relevance this kind of question has had. Okay. So we can start with chapter one, which is chapter two in the notes. About geometric mechanics. So what I will speak today about is symplectic geometry. I know you have already seen it, so hopefully, I don't know if all of you, how many of you have taken mathematical physics and seen more of this? Everybody-ish. Okay. So for the others, and also for everybody, please slow me down if there's something that is confusing or not clear. So as usual, in these cases, it's good to start from the beginning, which is the action principle. One last thing, sorry. There will be mathematical physics 2 running in parallel to this course, taught by Kevin. And this year, Kevin decided to deal with topics closely related to this course, in fact. So I'm sure the approach and the content of the courses and the goals of the courses will be different, but there will be a large superposition in themes, which hopefully is working well in the seeing the same thing twice from two different perspectives usually helps. So, but I wanted to say that there will be some superposition. Okay, so action principle. What is an action? An action is a functional over the space of history. So this is a history defined as the integral between an initial and the final time of some Lagrangian function, which most of the time we will assume to be just a function of q and q dot. So I will not repeat all I've said in classical physics again. And there I explain in particular why q and q dot can be is correct to understand them as independent variables in the right sense, and so on and so forth. Here I will work a bit more formally. So here, what is a history? A history q of t is a map from R into some space q, which is configuration space. Space, and this is time. And the Lagrangian is a function on, if it is a force, or like a Lagrangian that involves only q and q dot, is a function on on the tangent bundle of q into the reals, right? So a position and a vector field on the position, which is the velocity q dot, gives into the real, and it can be evaluated on, maybe I should write it as v here, and then it can be evaluated on a history at different times, and therefore it gives something we can integrate on. Okay, now how do we do mechanics from here? Well, we take a variation of this Lagrangian. And as usual, we write it as dl over is the variation in the position plus the variation in the velocity. Let's say derivative over v, over q dot. And this is, what is the variation in q dot? It's just the time derivative of the variation in q. And now what we can do, of course, is to integrate these by parts. And what you obtain is the Euler-Lagrange equation. Q plus T1, T0 over here. Okay, so this these are the Euler-Lagrange equations of motion. And what is this piece? Well, here we recognize the canonical momentum P. And here we have delta Q. So the action principle says that for physical trajectories satisfying the Euler-Lagrange equations of motion are a stationary point of the action with fixed boundary conditions. So physical trajectory, stationary history of S at fixed delta Q at T1 and T0. So that this term can drop and one is left with the having to satisfy this equation. So the idea here is that they have T, Q, a bunch of histories like that. And the one that is physical is the one at which this variation vanishes. So the stationary history is the one satisfying delta S equals zero, of course. This is the usual. Now, we will see later today that this structure, PDQ, will play an important role when doing symplectic geometry. Now, and this covariant phase space method is exactly a formalism, is a way to study mechanics from this covariant perspective of the space of histories. And understanding this boundary term of the variation of the action has something that we're not just throwing away to find the equations of motion, but something that plays an important role in the formulation of mechanics. Before getting there, I want, however, to study symplectic geometry in the phase space in the more standard way, because there will be important parallels and differences, and it's good to review what the standard formulation is at first. So once we define the canonical momentum P as dl over dq dot, we can, I don't know why this chokes. We can define an Hamiltonian function, which is pq dot minus l qq dot, where here q dot is understood as a function of p and q obtained by inverting this. So what is the advantage of doing this this transformation is that now the equations of motion are first order. So in particular, the Euler-Lagrange equation hold if and only if p dot I is dh over, sorry, minus dh over dqi, and q dot I is dh over dp. And the reason why we're happy that these are first order is, well, first of all, from a PDE perspective, there is a general solution for first order ordinary differential equations, since these are equations in T, first order ODE in T. But also there is, and the reason, essentially the reason why there is this universal way of solving, like an algorithmic way of solving these equations, is because they have a clear geometrical understanding. So what is this understanding? The understanding is that in the phase space, so geometric meaning in phase space. What is phase space? In this case that I'm considering here is the space T star Q, where instead of having positions and velocities, we have positions and momenta. And the coordinate is given by exactly by that. So what is this understanding? Well, given a given a Hamiltonian function, Hamiltonian H PQ, PQ, what we can do is to define X, sorry, this choke is really not. As the following, so this is a vector field. Vector field on P on phase space with components with the following components. Minus dH over dQ and dH over dP. So these are the P components. This is the d over dP. Well, let me write it in a slightly different way, which makes it clearer. Minus dH over dQi, d over dPi plus dH over dPi. So this is a vector field over phase space, and the dynamics is about integrating this vector field. So following the flow of this vector field on phase space. So for example, we have something like that. And solving the dynamics means finding the integral curves of these vector fields. Dynamics equal integral curves of XH. So we can start from an initial point, which is given by some initial Q and P. And given this, we just have to follow the arrows, and we obtain the evolution of the system. All clear up to here? Again, it's just a fast recap. Now, you've probably also seen that all of these can be rephrased in the language of Poisson brackets. So a Poisson bracket is something that takes function two functions over phase space and gives you a third one. So it takes f and g and sends it to fg, which is the sum over df over dp. Let me get it right. dp dg over dq minus the other way around. And one can notice that XH is nothing else than this type of operation where we plug in only one slot and what you obtain is a vector field, which is exactly this one. Well, maybe up to a sign, okay. The note should be consistent. The blackboard is a bit more wobbly in terms of signs. Okay, so now what we want to do is somehow to, instead of starting from an action and doing this transform and so on, we just take as a postulate that mechanics is defined over some phase space P and try to understand, we will give a different way of studying, of formulating these Poisson brackets in a sense, a dual way in terms of differential forms that contain the same information as here and allows us to also talk about Hamiltonian vector field like this X and so on and so forth. Why we will do that? Because when we come from the action and field theory, is a more natural, is what we obtain naturally from the action principle in that sense. So we will see that we will get something that looks like P delta Q naturally, and later on we will understand what is the exact relationship between these two pictures, which is a bit more subtle than one thinks at first sight. Okay. So here is. So usually up to here, everybody should have seen this. Now symplectic geometry, I think most of you have seen it, but if you didn't, just slow me down. Okay, let's start with a definition. What is a symplectic space? Symplectic manifold. So a symplectic manifold is a combination of two things. A manifold P is a 2n dimensional differential manifold. It's even dimensional, must be. So intuitively, for every Q, there is a P. And omega is a two-form, a differential two-form on P with the following two properties. Such that, one, well, I write it in word, is closed, and two, non-degenerate. So like on the internet, capital letters is like screaming. So you have to remember these two properties for the rest of the course. So closed and non-degenerate is what defines a symplectic manifold, and both are needed. We will see that we will deal with many omegas which will be degenerate. They will not be symplectic. So some of the properties of a symplectic manifold we will go through, but one has to be mindful that something that is degenerate is not symplectic. Okay, so what do these two properties mean formally? So this is to explain next. So what does close mean? Well, this is, in a way, the simple one. It means that d omega is equal to 0. Can you see? I have the impression these chokes are not great. Yeah? OK. I will come back to these to comment on the consequences of this equation in a moment. But for now, it's just the fact that d omega is equal to 0. Of course, this is a very compact formulation. What it means is that the antisymmetric derivative of omega vanishes. Now, non-degenerate. I will give, there are various, a couple of possible definitions. I will give the most general one, what that will go through also in field theory, where P is infinite dimensional. And then I will draw consequences for the finite dimensional case. So what I want you to think about omega being non-degenerate is that omega flat. So what is omega flat? Omega flat is it's a map between the tangent space and the cotangent space. Is basically I'm contracting a vector on one of the two indices of omega, and so I get an object with the index low. So I take z. I will call z points in P without distinguishing Qs and Ps, like it's a coordinate z. And x are usually vectors in this game. So an omega flat of z at x is z. Again, I need a base point and ix omega at z. So what is this? Is the contraction. I don't know. There are lots of symbols for this. Are you familiar with the I symbol in coordinates? So this could be denoted sometimes. I never know where the little hook goes, whether it's left or right. Sometimes it's denoted like that. But that's, I will not use this notation. I will use the I. Sometimes it's also denoted omega x, maybe at z. Okay. In any case, what it means is that I'm contracting one of the two indices. So this will be xi omega ij dzj. So all these things are just the same. Of course, this is in coordinates, whereas these are more abstract versions of this. Questions about this? I see some heads. Okay. So what about this map? So the flat, okay, a comment about why there is a flat here. A flat here is from musical notation. It takes a note slightly down. So what is happening here is taking the index down. So we take a vector, which has an index up, and we get out a form, which has an index down. So that's why it's a flat. A map that does the opposite would be a sharp. So what we ask is that this map is injective. So this is the demand of non-degeneracy. So this demand goes through also in infinite dimensions. I'm not asking that it's invertible. I'm just asking that it is injective. Injectivity is fine even in infinite dimensions. Now, in finite dimensions, if one demands injectivity of a form with these properties, one gets back also surjectivity for free. So it's also invertible. In finite dimension, this implies surjectivity, which implies bijectivity. Okay. So, and this is due to the fact that this is an antisymmetric matrix. So if it's injective, it's also surjective. So now let's look at this formula, at this writing over here. What does this invertible means? This invertible means that as a matrix, omega j minus 1 is well defined. Is well defined. What is this object? This object I wanted to mention it later, but this object will be related to the Poisson bracket. Bracket C below. I will say more about it in a second. Okay, so there are different. I like to think of it in terms of injectivity because it's more general, but in finite dimension is the same as saying that the matrix pointwise at every z, this matrix is invertible and defines something with two indices up. Okay. So how does this very general setup relate to the P's and Q's of before? This is where we're going now. So theorem. Q is an n-dimensional manifold. The theorem says that then T equal T star Q is symplectic, is canonically symplectic. So, how do you build it? Well, let me go a little slow here. So we start from, there is a very intrinsic formulation, which is abstract. It's a bit hard to grasp, so I will not go through it. It's in the notes. Here I give a more down-to-earth coordinate version of how to build the symplectic structure on P. So P is even dimensional, of course, is double the dimension of Q, so we are well set. And but what happens to, how do we build this kind of, this symplectic structure? So the on T, Q, T star Q, at a point Q is just a vector space. And the basis is dqi. This is a basis at Q. Now, what are a general vector on over here? Alpha. So n, let me say, with n vector space with basis delta q. And I will denote pi the coordinates on T star Q. What does it mean? This means that an alpha over in here can be written as the sum of some components pi of alpha over dqi. So what does this mean? This is also telling us that Z equal qi pi are coordinates on P. And therefore, this tells us that theta defined as pi, so theta at Q and P defined like this is a one form over P. So this is called the symplectic potential. And it looks a lot like the P delta Q over there. They're not the same thing, but they are related. But they're not the same. Now, why it's called a potential? It's called a potential because if we derive it, we get omega. Which is symplectic. It's obviously closed because it's exact, and it's also non-degenerate because it's easy to see. So this is a coordinate description of what is going on. One would have to check, when I say canonical, it means that it doesn't depend on a choice of coordinates. One has to check that this is the case, and it is. So any possible choice of coordinate Q on the base manifold will lead to the same form at the end of the day. Will not lead to the same theta necessarily. I think also theta. Also theta is universal. So these two objects are intrinsic to the manifold. Okay. Now the very powerful thing is that why I can write these in coordinates and be kind of happy. There is also a reverse of these, which is called the Darboux theorem. Which says that if P omega is symplectic, locally, and I will say exactly what this means, looks like T star Q.
One question about, so this, how is this again related to the boundary term that we got in the variation?
This is what we will discuss. We will build up to it. We will fully understand it only in part three. So it will take a little while.
Okay.
But I want to just to mention that that's the direction we are going towards. The delta here has a very different meaning than the d there, right? So this is a history. This is the variation of a history. That's a coordinate on a finite dimensional space. So they're not the same. We end up using the same q, but it's a bit of a notational mishap that they have the same symbol there. Same for p, but OK. So what does this mean technically? Technically, it means that given a z, namely, for all z in p, so we take a point in configuration space, there exists an open neighborhood. U with coordinates, well, this is of course Rn, and we will put coordinates q1, qn, p1, pn on this thing, such that omega restricted to U in this open neighborhood and U and coordinates. There exists open neighborhood and coordinates. So of course this is my coordinate map, right? That one that realized these diffeomorphisms, local diffeomorphism, where this is precisely. So this is Zi, okay. So this means that every time I'm given a symplectic manifold locally, and by locally, I want to emphasize here what I mean is in an open neighborhood. Okay, green doesn't work, but this is very important, and I will say in a second why. I can choose coordinates where it looks like a cotangent bundle. So here, it's important that it's an open neighborhood for the following reason. I want to draw a parallel between symplectic geometry and Riemannian geometry. In Riemannian geometry, one of the starting points was to say, oh, we have a manifold with a metric, and locally this manifold looks like Rn. But what did we mean there by locally? There we meant that at every point, there exist coordinates that make g mu nu equal to the Minkowski metric at that point. We know also that we can go farther to 1/4 order neighborhood, where we'll still look like that, but we can't do it at second order, because at second order, we get the curvature. So second derivative of the metric are give you the Riemann tensor, and so there is, we can't set g mu nu in the canonical form eta mu nu on open neighborhoods, because already a second order in derivatives, it doesn't work. So here, what we are obtaining is something much more rigid in a sense. So the model space, this t star of q, is valid in open neighborhoods. And the reason is essentially this. So roughly, we are looking at, of course, also in Riemannian geometry, we have an equation like there is a compatibility of sorts. But this is a compatible connection with that. Here we're doing something slightly different. And this equation is strong enough that kind of rigidifies things. the counterintuitive aspect of this story is that whereas making things more rigid in a way gives you more symmetries, not less symmetries. So you know that if you have a Riemannian manifold, symmetries are described by Killing vector fields, which are the objects that keep your metric invariant, like the vector fields that keep your invariant. And there can be only a finite number of them. And on an arbitrary manifold, there is none. Here, instead, since we can copy the model manifold on open neighborhoods, in some sense, things are more rigid. So in a way, there are we expect there to be more symmetries, maybe. I don't know. But that's what comes out. So the vector fields that preserve your symplectic structure, in fact, there are infinitely many of them, contrary to Riemannian geometry, where there is only a finite number of them. So these I will get to the symmetries in a second, but I want that's an important observation. So there are similarities in moral similarities between this story and the one about Riemann manifold, but the geometrical structures behind, the mathematical structures, are very different and behave very different. So one has to be careful about when one says, oh, locally things are like that. One has to be careful about what one actually means by that. So maybe I can give the definition here. So definition, phi is as a diffeomorphism of P, such that phi omega is equal to omega, is a symplectomorphism. This is just the definition. So if you think of a diffeo that preserves the metric, is an isometry. Here, the analog is a symplectomorphism. The infinitesimal version is what? Is a vector field over the manifold. This is the infinitesimal version of diffeos. That does what? Whose lead derivative of omega vanishes is a symplectomorphism. Or sometimes people say is a symplectic vector field or something like that. Remark. There exist infinitely many symplectomorphisms. Or what does it mean, infinitely many? This doesn't mean anything. In fact, what I mean is that the group of symplectomorphism is infinite dimensional, except that symplectomorphism at large are not really a group, but in any case, there are technicalities, but the idea is that the group is infinite dimensional. And we will see, hopefully by the end of the lecture, a family of these infinitely dimensional. But why there are infinitely many? There is an obvious way to see that there are infinitely many of them. Okay, to get there, let me go back to the analogy with the, no, not the analogies, the correspondence to the Poisson formulation that we mentioned earlier. So, omega non-degenerate implies that I can define an object like this, which is a bivector field defined as follows. Well, this is more of an equivalence, Pij, Z, Dzi, Dzj, which is equal to omega ij at z inverse like that. And what does this you see, this is a bivector, so this is an anti-symmetrized tensor product of vectors. But in practice, how do we use this? Well, this is what defines the Poisson bracket, right? So we get that F and G associated to P is equal to, I just plug in my functions in here. So this is pi aj z df dz I dg dz j. So using Darboux coordinates, this looks like what we had written before. This is just df over dp dg over dq minus the opposite. Darboux coordinates. So coordinates that realize this theorem are called Darboux coordinates. So we know, so how do we know that, okay, so sorry, let me think how to phrase this a second. So we knew that omega is closed and non-degenerate. We use its non-degeneracy property to define the inverse already. What is the closedness of omega telling us? So proposition, omega symplectic defines a pi, which is non-degenerate. Sorry, let me put it this way. Defines a bracket, so let's forget about the P. I will not use it that much. Defines a bracket, which is what? Which is skew. Skew properties is kind of obvious. Omega is a two form, is anti-symmetric in its indices, so this will be skew. And it is it is a derivation for obvious reasons, because it's built out of these vector fields. So it's obviously a derivation, a biderivation, if you want, in both its arguments. And most importantly, satisfies Jacobi. So this is the hard one, right? So Jacobi comes from the closeness of omega. And it's a nice exercise to prove this. You can prove it in coordinates. It's kind of in coordinates is kind of obvious. Why? Because you use Darboux theorem. You say that it takes this form, and you know that this form satisfies Jacobi because you have shown it 1,000,000 times. More interestingly, you can try to prove this abstractly by feeding functions to here and see what happens to at the omega level. So for this, however, we need a couple more equations. So, and this is where I will conclude. So remember, inspired by this formula that I talked about at the beginning of the class, that given a function, we can get a vector field on phase space. So given a Hamiltonian, we can get a Hamiltonian flow. Here we can do it for any function. So what we do is to define xf is the Hamiltonian vector field of f of the function f. And now we want to give a symplectic. So this is a Poisson characterization of this vector field. We want to give a symplectic characterization. So equivalently, NX, a vector field such that, so in fact, I should have I should have done it oppositely. So how do we define more abstractly? NX, a vector field such that there exists a function with the following property, Ix of omega equal minus dfx is called Hamiltonian. So how do you prove that there is the same relationship holds than here? Well, we can, in coordinate is kind of clear, right? So we write xi omega ij equal minus dj of f. Now this is invertible. And because of the signs, I believe you get a plus, but this is done again a bit better in using the skew symmetry. You have to invert the indices and stuff like that, permute them. So you get this, but sorry, I should write pi, because pi equal omega minus 1. And so this is, by definition, precisely f with an open, sorry. This is f, so xi di is f with an open slot. I think that's what I'm, oh. Minus j, I think it's like that. So the minus is eaten because I'm inverting those two to write the second equation. So now, the last equation I want to write is to go back to that statement, which is saying that Lx, Hamiltonian vector field, are simple ectomorphisms. So you write this. What is this? You use Cartan's formula. If you don't know it, let me know. We can go through it together. This is closed. And this is a d square of f of x, which is 0. So for every function f, you can build the corresponding Hamiltonian vector field, which is a simple ectomorphism. So it's clearly an infinite dimensional space. OK? So this is all for today. And thanks.